Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is December the 4th, 2019. A shout out to all the military men and women serving our country and is away from home at this time of the year. We thank you for your service. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, it's 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org. In the computer news, competition for Qualcomm in 5G technology from Apple. How safe are we from 5G radiation? 5G technology today and beyond. What is Harmony OS? The Senate report finds China exploiting U.S. schools to steal research. Feature segments this evening. Benjamin Rockwell in his IT Pro series, he's going to cover personally identifiable information. And a new segment, On the Mark with Mark Leoso, My Charge PowerFold Review. From the Tech Corner, shopping for stocking stuffers. All Hands on Tech with Marty Winston, and he'll cover LED replacement headlights. Late breaking news. There's now competition for Qualcomm in 5G technology from Apple. Apple just completed a $1 billion acquisition in an agreement for Apple to acquire the majority of Intel's smartphone business unit. Apple's acquisition of the bulk of Intel's smartphone business, valued at $1 billion, was completed this Monday. Intel did the deal at a multi-billion dollar loss. Approximately 2,200 Intel employees will join Apple, along with intellectual property, equipment, and leases. The completion of the deal, first announced in July, came after Intel filed an amicus brief opposing Qualcomm's appeal of the landmark FTC judgment back in May, which found Qualcomm guilty of abusing its chip patent monopoly. According to the filing, Intel, the sale of its modem business to Apple at a multi-billion dollar loss, and it was the only way forward in the face of Qualcomm's relentless effort to warp the playing field. Apple sued Qualcomm back in April over royalty charges for the company's cellular communications technology before settling things with a six-year global license agreement. Intel pulled out of the smartphone modem business. Though it has stepped back from smartphone cellular communications, the company has continued to tout 5G for PCs. Of course, those chips would feature the MediaTek name. Combining the acquired patents for current and future wireless technology with Apple's existing portfolio, Apple will now hold over 17,000 wireless technology patents, ranging from protocols for cellular standards to modem architecture and modem operation. Intel will retain the ability to develop modems for non-smart modem applications such as PCs, Internet of Things devices, and autonomous vehicles. Qualcomm is currently appealing the May antitrust judgment and won a partial stay in August at the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court for the requirement that it licenses critical patents to the competition. Intel has been supporting the FTC against its arch-rival Qualcomm. The closure of the deal brings another element of Apple's supply chain in-house, assuming it is able to get the 5G technology it has purchased to actually perform as required. How safe are we from 5G radiation? Whenever there is an introduction of new technology, there is always concern what the effect may be on its impact on health. Some of these concerns are speculative without any scientific data of study. Both industry and government needs to work harder to counter any misinformation and ensure that the community is armed with the facts to enable it to embrace the technology that will bring so many benefits to people's lives. 5G cellular technology emits radio frequency, that's RF radiation, and it does so at ultra-high frequencies and with ultra-high intensity compared to earlier technologies. The World Health Organization classified RF radiation as a possible carcinogenic in 2011. Possible is a precaution, not a definitive statement. Unfortunately, many have selectively dropped the word possible when they bring up the subject and its concerns on health impact. As reported in the press in September of this year, thousands protest against 5G mobile rollout in Switzerland. The demonstration was held in Bern, organized by Frequencia against the rollout. It attracted thousands. Frequencia claims more than 3,000 people attended the protest. Switzerland is one of the first countries to roll out the new technology, which will eventually be used to support a new generation of technology, including driverless cars and virtual reality. Three Swiss mobile operators have together installed hundreds of 5G antennas across the country. Swisscom says it will be able to reach 90% of the population with its 5G network by the end of the year. However, the effects of the radiation emitted by 5G technology are controversial, and several studies are underway, including one by the World Health Organization. The Swiss government appointed a group of experts to look at the risk of 5G, and their findings are expected by the end of the year. Some people suffer from electromagnetic hypersensitivity, a condition that is not recognized as a medical disorder in most countries. Sufferers experience anything mild discomfort to an inability to function when exposed to the electromagnetic radiation produced by mobile and Wi-Fi technology. Frequencia is demanding changes to the technology and the way it is installed, and it wants to see greater use of fiber optics in building so that wireless mobile technology can be reserved for communications made on the move, which it claims make up only 20% of connections. This would reduce the number of antenna and the level of radiation. In addition, it is calling for radiation-free zones. Several Swiss cantons, including Geneva and Vaud, have put a freeze on issuing the permits required to erect new antenna. However, this does not prevent operators replacing existing 4G equipment with 5G technology on existing masts. In addition, there has been talk of a popular vote on the subject. Although 5G technology may have many unimagined uses and benefits, it is not clear that significant negative consequences to human health and ecosystems could occur if it was widely adopted. Current radio frequency radiation wavelengths that we are exposed to may appear to act as a toxin to biological systems. The benefit on the technology side is more bandwidth for everyone. You will have significantly more speed than 4G. Bigger bandwidth, however, means a smaller coverage area. Things are different now that we have multi-megabit download speeds. For most people, regular 3G internet is quite enough for mobile browsing. 3G cells have an enormous range of coverage of up to 45 miles. 4G has a range of up to 22 miles. With 5G, by contrast, the network is quicker. They're typically 1,000 to 10,000 times faster than the area of coverage, but its range of coverage is only 1,000 feet. Australia's two largest telcos have reported that the electromagnetic energy, that's EME, produced as a result of using 5G is much the same as many household items. The pair have added that the use of small cells is also not a cause for concern. Microwaves sit at 100 times below Australia's EME safety limit, and 5G is one or two orders of magnitude safer than that. EME in the home from mobile networks is typically below those emitted by standard household devices, such as a microwave or baby monitor. One of the two telcos, Telstra, said at a hearing that small cells provide faster connections and better response times at lower EME levels. leading up to the public launch of 5G with the 3.5 gigahertz network. What they found again was that they were getting a much faster response time because the network was quicker and you could deliver the signal quicker. That meant that the signal was lower and the EME levels were lower. In fact, they were very similar to 3G, 4G, and Wi-Fi. EME was similar to walkie-talkies, Wi-Fi hotspots, key tags, and remote controls. What they found was that because 5G is very efficient, it typically runs at a lower level than an everyday device in your house, like a baby monitor or a microwave oven. They're typically 1,000 to 10,000 times less than what you get from other devices. So when they add all that up together, it's all very low in terms of total emission. They found there is no evidence for cancer or non-thermal effects from radio frequency EME. There's some evidence for biological effects, but none of these are non-adverse. More studies are needed to verify the studies conducted in Australia. The submission also reiterated the scientific fact that radio waves are non-ionizing and cannot break chemical bonds that could lead to DNA damage. Is 5G radiation going to kill us? No, it's not going to kill anybody. No single scientific study considered in isolation will provide a meaningful answer to the question of whether or not radio waves can cause or contribute to adverse health effects in people, animals, or the environment. Although the studies by the Australian telcos are credible, we need more independent studies with balance, not cherry-picking data, and not taking a weight-of-evidence approach. Stay tuned. "5G in 2020 and beyond." With all the talk about 5G, it is an ambitious vision that spans not just smartphones, but cars and laptops. Qualcomm President Cristiano Amon, in a keynote speech at the Qualcomm's Analyst Day, made the following observations. "Avoid shopping for a 5G phone until maybe this time next year, and even then you'd better be ready for your experience of the next generation of wireless broadband to vary dramatically with your location. But the reality of the ground is much more spotty than the media hype. 5G is not just of devices, but of frequencies and timelines. That's not what much of the hype about 5G would lead you to believe, that this breakthrough development will reformat the future. The reality is much more complicated than that. Start with the frequencies 5G will use, which you can think of as a layer cake topped with millimeter wave bands. These millimeter wave bands will offer the fastest and most responsive connectivity, downloads exceeding 1 gigabit per second, and latency below 10 milliseconds, performance traditionally confined to wire broadband. Certain use cases in the smartphone would not be possible without millimeter wave, such scenarios as cloud-hosted games that would bring the high-resolution graphics of gaming consoles and cloud storage that would be functionally indistinguishable from flash storage on a smartphone. But millimeter wave 5G suffers from an exceedingly short reach, under 1,000 outdoor feet from cell site to smartphone, with indoor reception more problematic. On a national or worldwide level, millimeter wave 5G is years from being mainstream. Only U.S. carriers have adopted it so far, and they have yet to offer it outside parts of select cities. Filling in that patchy coverage will require setting up thousands of new cell sites. The city detail coverage maps that Verizon posted documents its millimeter wave 5G. For example, show that is confined to particular streets outdoors with the densest coverage in Chicago. In Verizon's case in New York, this millimeter wave 5G covers discrete blocks in Lower Manhattan, across Midtown, and at the southern corners of Central Park. The rest of the 5G layer cake consists of lower frequency bands, both those employed for today's low frequency LTE bands and others under 6 gigahertz that are set to be open for 5G service. They don't deliver millimeter wave speed and responsiveness, but cover much more ground. That's why the more expansive 5G network thus far in the United States that Sprint has with their millimeter wave frequencies in favor of the same 2.5 gigahertz band as in 4G LTE. Forecast for 5G coverage next year, it's fair to expect by 2020, you're going to have all metropolitan areas with 5G coverage, assumes that use of these slower but longer range bands to fill out the 5G coverage. Millimeter wave 5G hit 65% of outdoor coverage from existing LTE cell sites in San Francisco, but lower frequency 5G frequencies at existing LTE cities allow for 78% coverage in Frankfurt. And when you add spectrum shared as needed from 4G, the figure was 96%. But the customers served in those bottom slices of 5G layer cake won't get that hyper-responsive connectivity, which might make running everything from the cloud a much slower experience than you thought. Internationally, with support from carriers in Brazil, Chile, Germany, Italy, Russia, and Singapore, among others. Much of Qualcomm's own stake in 5G involves the chipsets inside Android smartphones. But although its X50 5G modem owns the nascent U.S. market, that only supports millimeter wave 5G and has to sit alongside Qualcomm's existing system on a chip hardware inside a phone. That makes today's 5G phones bigger and more battery hungry than they otherwise would be. It won't be until at least next year that a 5G compatible system on a chip that extends Qualcomm's Snapdragon line of phone processors will remedy those shortcomings. The customers served in those bottom slices of the 5G layer cake won't get that hyper-responsive connectivity in 2020. You're going to see 5G across the entire portfolio of products. The customers served in those bottom slices of the 5G layer cake won't get that hyper-responsive connectivity. In 2020, you're going to see 5G across the entire portfolio of products, and you'll see it driving as fast as possible the entire device ecosystem to 5G. Apple users will probably have to wait for that Cupertino-based firm to develop its own 5G circuitry for iPhones based on the Intel wireless modem business. Qualcomm's 5G ambitions extend beyond phones to Internet of Things appliances, industrial robots, and other connected gadgets. Network and increasingly autonomous automobiles represent one such future, with 18 automakers having selected Qualcomm's connected car platform. Qualcomm expects to be in the automotive car business to stay. Laptops are another. They pointed out that the new Microsoft Surface Pro X, introduced in early October, which includes a processor developed with Qualcomm as a model for a future of mobile computing, always connected to cloud services that can scale up for any possible need. The next transformation of the enterprise with a hyperscaler cloud is going to create an opportunity for more value with a connected PC experience. But as with smartphones, cars, and other 5G devices, the customer satisfaction with that connectivity may depend on a great deal on where they experience it and how companies selling this stuff meet people's expectation after raising high hopes for 5G technology. 2020, here we come. Huawei and Harmony OS. It's no secret that the geopolitical sparring disrupts Huawei's ability to trade in the world economy. Harmony OS is Huawei's ready-made backup plan when everything goes south. But that's not what Harmony OS really is. Huawei has tried to distill the essence of Harmony OS into a single slogan, a microkernel-based distributed operating system for all scenarios. At its core, Harmony OS is not an Android rival at all. It is a rival to any smart OS that you can probably imagine. Huawei talks about Harmony OS as the next step in connecting the end user to the ever-changing digital world. Huawei believes that the biggest changes are around the corner with the dawn of 5G. The increasing prevalence of cloud technology and artificial intelligence and emerging market Internet of Things. The problem is, says Huawei, that much of the smart technology that we use every day refuses to play nicely together. let alone seamlessly, instead of reusing the operating system, rebuilding the same apps, and putting more square pins into round holes, Huawei wants to unleash a new kind of operating system, and it says it has been working on it for almost 10 years. Huawei still leads 5G implementation. Despite U.S. ban, Huawei smartphone shipments can be put off by the trade dispute in the U.S., but the company's 5G deployment ambitions continue unhindered, at least according to Huawei. They boast about 200,000 5G compatible base. It is already difficult to have these products play together, even if you only count Huawei products. The phones work on Android, the laptops use Windows, while the smartwatches now use Lite OS. Opening the door to third-party smart home devices is an even bigger step in the incompatible city. In concept, the Huawei solution is simple. Create a secure operating system that is disconnected from the hardware that could work on all these devices. However, the implementation of that concept is far from easy. In concept, the Huawei solution is simple. Create a secure operating system that is disconnected from the hardware that could work on all these devices. However, the implementation of that concept is far from easy. Huawei OS is built on one kernel, one app framework, and uses the same core services. Regardless of the hardware, Huawei says that by removing redundant code and using more efficient planning model based on a real-time deterministic latency engine, those are just fancy words, that reassigns resources in real time. Harmony OS represents a step above monolithic and hybrid kernel architectures such as Linux and Android respectively. Huawei says it went beyond individual devices and isolated hardware functions and instead determined a pool of combined capabilities and features to create a virtualized hardware level. This pool of shared resources include broader features such as monitors, cameras, speakers, and microphones, and elements that repeat themselves on different smart devices. According to Huawei, Harmony OS is at home on a phone or laptop with a 12 GB RAM, just like on a smart light bulb with only kilobytes of memory. The potential benefits are numerous, but the example that Huawei presents is switching between one device and another while using a single app without downtime. Calling on your phone, why not drive it to the dashboard of your car while you're driving or to your tablet or TV when you get home? Another advantage is that Harmony OS apps only ever have to be written for one platform, and this will only shorten development time in general. It also offers compatibility on multiple devices. All this means that you have a single software driver for all devices because they have a single kernel that addresses all the functions of the peripherals. Harmony, as an operating system, still has a long ways to go. Of course, a good operating system for the coming years is well and good, but nobody uses an operating system alone. You need devices. Huawei already produces its own Kirin silicon, has a huge investment in cloud technology, as at the heart of 5G around the world. Whether governments like it or not, it also has a thriving device industry that covers phones, wearables, tablets, laptops, and more. Huawei can use that broad portfolio as a springboard for the new OS. Huawei relies on the open source nature of Harmony OS to build the platform. Huawei wants other OEMs to wear the Harmony OS torch, not only in the smart home sector, but also in the mobile market. Open source or not, Huawei wants to establish itself as the de facto mobile hardware, software and infrastructure company in China. Huawei has competing products in almost every category on the Harmony OS roadmap. Crucial components such as the Huawei plans for an app store for Harmony OS are still a total mystery, and apart from the ability to seamlessly switch devices while using the same app, Android apps are also not directly compatible. Will Huawei be able to convince all leading app makers to reproduce their wares for yet another platform? We'll see. At the moment, it's difficult to see that only political solidarity that companies pull away from Google operating system and the almost unassailable global reputation and popularity that comes with it. We know that Android apps are also not directly compatible. Will Huawei be able to convince all leading app makers to reproduce their wares for yet another platform? Google may even choose to restrict access to its immensely popular app family in an effort to weaken a potential rival if Huawei completely abandons Android. Harmony OS is a much easier sale for the Internet of Things market where fragmentation is commonplace. There is no ubiquitous operating system for Internet of Things devices, and Huawei has a huge opportunity to strengthen its place at the head of the table. But Huawei contradicts its own message by chasing Android so fiercely. Why buy for this? Operating system of the future for all our devices when Huawei is not fully committed. Whether by force or by choice, the new operating system from Huawei is somewhere on a crash course with Android. They still have a ways to go. In the Washington Times, they are reporting the U.S. Senate is citing that China has been exploiting U.S. schools to steal research. China has built its economy in part on research funded by taxpayers in the United States, then siphoned across the Pacific Ocean by academics recruited by Beijing to act as double agents, stealing intellectual property from the American universities. This was revealed in a bipartisan Senate report. The academics signed contracts that, in some cases, committed them to hiding their dual research status from the U.S. employers while giving China a first look at their work. The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Permanent Subcommittee on Investigation found Beijing's interest in stealing U.S. military and economic secrets has long been known, but the federal government was slow to act. American taxpayers have been unwittingly funding the rise of China's economy and military over the last two decades. Our own federal agency have done little to stop their actions, despite being aware of China's talent plans. One China-backed researcher downloaded more than 30,000 files from an Energy Department lab and then fled back to China. In another instance, the report detailed how a professor at an American university working in a science field with both civilian and military applications found a way to circumvent a U.S. export rules and get his findings back to China. Investigators said he was paid by federal agencies to perform research while running a China-based lab, and he sponsored visiting Chinese students in the United States, and he then used students to transfer his research back to China without having to travel himself. The federal agency that investigated the case said that many of the visiting students were directly affiliated with research and development organizations involved in China's military modernization efforts. Senate investigators said China has more than 200 programs to recruit research talent at home and abroad. The Senate report looks at one of them, the Thousand Talents Plan, which is directly run by the Communist Party Central Committee. Investigators obtained some of the contracts that Thousand Talents Plan recruits signed with China and found researchers were pledging to hide their ties from U.S. institutions, all while promising to share their findings with the Chinese overseers. One contract urged a researcher to run shadow labs in China, and other contracts require researchers to recruit others into the program. One Senate investigator compared it to a pyramid scheme and said it was no wonder the Thousand Talents Plan exceeded Beijing's goals for growth. Chinese Talent Recruitment Plan members misappropriated U.S. government funding, provided early basic research ideas for their Chinese employers, stole intellectual capital from U.S. basic research before it was published, and engaged in intellectual property theft. The director of the FBI told Congress that the Bureau is increasingly concerned about China's talent recruitment strategy and pointed out that the U.S. taxpayer is often providing the money for the research that is advancing China's economic dominance over us. But the FBI was slow on the draw, as reported by the Senate report. The Bureau had a list of China-backed researchers in 2016 and didn't share the information for 2 years. The senators who ran the investigation said the government needs a better strategy. The State Department could do more to try to screen out potential double agent researchers applying for visas to visit the U.S. federal law enforcement for visas to visit the U.S. Federal law enforcement need to share more data with universities, and the schools should do more to vet whom they are hiring. The report also suggested that the administration slap restrictions on research funded by American taxpayers. After public scrutiny last year, China moved to delete references to the Thousand Talents Plan. A list of participating scientists was scrubbed from the internet, and a Chinese news outlet reported that a directive came from the High ordering media to suspend reporting on the program out of concern for researchers' safety. Here, we're doing the research for them, providing the information, or at taxpayers' expense, and it's being reported, but we're slow to act to do something about it. Benjamin Rockwell, in his IT Pro series, he's going to cover personally identifiable information.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and this is where I put on my work hat, and I talk about things that are talked about a lot in the business place. And this is a topic that really stretches over into the personal lives of many listeners. Actually, I would say all listeners. I don't know because I can't identify you. Why can't I identify you? Because there are things called the Privacy Act of 1974 and the Privacy Act of 2005. There's things, well, I'm not going to talk about your health, so I don't know that I'm covered by HIPAA, but which is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, and I'm not your doctor, so that might not apply to me as well. But there is something called the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, and that is that's under European regulations. However, we have decided to start utilizing that here. What am I talking about? Okay, so we're going to dive into a 50,000-foot view. I'm sorry, just a dive in. Yeah, okay. But you got the idea. I'm giving you just a brief idea of what they mean by personal information or personally identifying information or sensitive personal information or personal health information. Or, look, there's all of these different phrases and different frameworks that all mean the same thing. Companies need to keep the information of their customers and everybody they deal with private. They need to secure it. And we break this down, and every bit and piece of your information about you can be segmented into how dangerous is it for someone, a hacker, a bad guy, the third-party companies that are out there to get that information and to tie it to other bits and pieces of information to find out who you individually are and to somehow use that against you. So we've heard about, you know, a lot of these different hacks and things like this. And you need to be careful about how your name is associated with certain things. And sometimes this breaks down in different areas. So I'm going to give you just a brief view here of the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And this is a non-regulatory agency of the Department of Commerce here in the United States that has set together a lot of these different things and said, we can tie this to individuals. So your social security number here in the United States can be tied to just you. Well, okay, maybe a couple of other people that are not utilizing your social security, or that they are utilizing your social security number, not necessarily against you, but for their own purposes. But your bank account numbers, your passport number, your driver's license number, even your credit card numbers get down to mostly individual usage. Yes, you might share a credit card number with your spouse, so this is kind of a wobbler. but a lot of credit cards are tied to the individual. So the responsibility of a company to protect those bits and pieces of information is very, very high. They're not supposed to release that out. Now, we get into lower levels of data, not much lower, because on their own, they may be innocuous or less dangerous, but when they start being tied to other things, then they can tie that down to you, the individual. For instance, your full name. Okay, my full name is Benjamin Rockwell. Well, we won't get into my middle name or any of that, but there are other Benjamin Rockwells out there. There's a guy off in New Mexico that is a world expert on lasers. There's a Benjamin Rockwell that was involved. He was a skateboarder, and there's a park after him off in, I think it's Oregon or Washington. It doesn't matter. But you can see how that name, Benjamin Rockwell, can lead to a few different people. But you tie that in with what city that I live in, that makes it easier to locate who I am. You tie that in with a home address, it's a lot easier. So your full name, your home address, your city, your state, your zip code, those are all different items that are on a lesser level. They're still falling in under that information. And then we start getting into telephone numbers and your age and your date of birth and even things like web cookies. So you may wish to remain anonymous. You may wish that you be not identifiable directly, but we're going to be able, if we tie things together, we can find out that a person of a certain age and a certain race and a certain job description, we may tie that down to that individual very quickly just by piecing apart different pieces of information. So all of this information is protected to various degrees. And we are going to find in the coming years that there's going to be a lot more attention paid to this. There are a lot of people that are complaining about the idea that I can go onto the internet. I, you, me, we can go onto the internet. And yes, we can be tied. We log onto a website and we can be tied directly back to not only all of the information I've talked about, but how much we make and what kind of cars we're going to be interested in buying and other things like that. All of this privacy series of regulations aren't going to protect us as much as you think they will. I hate to say this, but this is a world where, as much as they legislate all of this, we are becoming far more public, far more available to the world. All of our information, all of our identifying marks are out there. But that's okay, because often we give this away for free. Yeah, maybe not. I don't know. Tell me what you think. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Shopping for stocking stuffers. Although the holiday shopping period is shorter than other years, you need not fret thinking about what to get as stocking stuffers. Here are some suggestions that are under $50. An easy suggestion is to gift USB flash drives or flash memory cards. Instead of the standard size SD memory card, get it as a micro SD with the SD adapter, and it could be used then in multiple devices. These are very useful for data storage. The only problem is that the optics of the gift, that when you wrap it up, the packaging is so small in size that it won't generate that awe of a larger package. Another suggestion are smart speakers like the Amazon Echo Dot and the Google Home Mini. The Google Home Mini measures 3.86 inches in diameter and 1.65 inch high, and the Amazon Echo Dot measures 3.9 inches in diameter and 1.7 inches in thickness. They're both very similar in measurements. They're both slightly larger than the standard regulation hockey puck, which is 1 inch thick by 3 inches in diameter. But with a very little effort, I'm sure it can be stuffed into the overhanging stocking. You can also give as a stocking stuffer a portable battery power pack. These come in varying sizes. When in use, carry one or two with you with the appropriate cable. In my case, Murphy's Law is the operative norm. If I did not bring one with me, I wish I had, but when I do carry with me a power pack as small as a flashlight stick, it's never needed. The only problem I have had with these power packs is that I always forget to charge them up first before use. I have asked Mark Leoso to do first look reviews of consumer products of interest. I ask that it be an honest review, whether or not the product is on or off the mark for the consumer public, and to avoid geek verbiage and regurgitation of the press release.
I'm Mark Leoso with On The Mark. Has your phone run low on power while off the grid? Carrying power banks or extra batteries isn't efficient or sustainable and adds weight to your bag, especially on a day outdoors or a multi-day hike. A lighter, eco-friendly solution is converting sunlight into electrical energy. There are many options. The new MyCharge PowerFold captures energy from the sun. It uses three small solar panels to store energy in a detachable power bank, convenient for when the solar panels aren't needed. It has the profile of a smartphone, measuring 3 by 6 inches and 3/4 of an inch thick. The panels and battery are neatly held together in a durable gray fabric case with an elastic clasp. The flexible MyFold makes it easy to drape the solar panels over stones or tree limbs for the best charging angle. It weighs a bit more than 11 ounces and easily fits into my pants back pocket. The MyCharge PowerFold comes out of the box fully charged, and I charged an iPhone X that had 15% power. It took a bit less than 2 hours to fully charge the iPhone, and the PowerFold had power to spare. The power bank holds a maximum 8,000 milliamp charge that will fully charge a smartphone 2 to 3 times, depending on your phone's battery. A short micro USB cable is included in the package, and using AC current, fully charged the PowerFold in a bit less than 4 hours. The output has a maximum of 2.4 amps. That means you'll quickly charge most smartphones, tablets, smartwatches, headphones, and small Bluetooth speakers. If you're worried about damaging your devices, the power bank has 2 USB-A ports with built-in smart sensors to determine your device's compatibility. That said, you'll need your own USB-C cables to take along. There's a 9-LED flashlight on the back of the battery. It's activated by a small button on the side of the power bank. A second press activates a flashing SOS. With adequate brightness, that enables SOAR from 3 New York City blocks. These features are helpful while in the backcountry or emergency situations. The PowerFold instructions claim 4 hours of direct sunlight provides up to 1 extra battery. On a bright late autumn morning, went out to New York City's Central Park and draped the unit on the back of a park bench. I moved it occasionally for maximum sun exposure. A green solar icon on the power bank's face lights up when the solar panels are energized, and 4 dark blue lines show the level of power stored. After 4.5 hours, the PowerFold hit 4 bars, indicating a full charge and time for a late lunch. The MyCharge PowerFold is a sustainable way to charge your small digital devices. It's rugged, attractive, and a useful addition to your outdoor packing list or your emergency go bag. The MyCharge PowerFold cost about $50 and is on the mark. For more information, visit MyCharge.com. That's On The Mark. I'm Mark Leosa.
Thank you, Mark. All Hands on Tech with Marty Winston, and he'll cover LED replacement headlights.
I'll bet you don't pay very much attention to your car's headlights. Most drivers who think about headlights at all tend to think about how angry they get when oncoming cars with those overly bright blue headlights make it really uncomfortable and really difficult to see anything. Every time it happens to me, I think about, inventing something to pop up a mirror and reflect the light right back at those drivers. Haven't done it yet. You're welcome to. Let me know. Listen, almost every headlight on the road is based on one of three technologies. Standard headlights tend to be based on halogen bulbs. HID headlights, that's short for high intensity discharge. Not really short for hideous, but it's those bright ones. They're also called xenon lights. And, as you might guess, these days LEDs are also showing up in headlights, both in some new cars and as replacements for original equipment headlights. Sometimes the headlamp is a housing with a lensed front, a mirrored back, and a receptacle that holds a glass-encased bulb. Well, you put the bulb in through the mounting hole in the back. From outside the housing, it locks into place. It's done. Other times, especially with LED headlamps, the housing is the headlamp, with the LED emitters and other components mounted on a circuit board within the housing. I don't want to dwell too much on the pieces and parts of all that, but I did want to mention all this at least once. Headlights put up with a lot more grief than the light bulbs in your house. There's constant vibration, a lot of bumps and jolts, and they have to survive some wicked temperature extremes. As you might guess, all of that can hurt their life expectancy. I'll call out some specifics on that in a minute, but let me put this into context. Say your ride to work involves a total of 3 hours a day, hour and a half each way, and that's 5 days a week, 15 hours. Add another 10 hours of headlight time for running around you do after dark and on weekends, 25 total hours per week. That's not necessarily true for each and every one of you, but it's a decent reference point, for starters at least. Or is it? A traditional halogen headlight bulb has a rated service life of 450 to 1,000 hours. For that kind of driving that I just profiled, you'd be burning them out every 4.5 to 10 months. And you don't. So let's correct the presumption. About half of the year, the sun will already be up when you head to work and will still be up when you head home. For the other half of the year, it'll tend to be up for one direction but dark for the other. And most people make it to work in an hour or less. So make a similar adjustment for the rest of your driving, and your total headlights on driving time might be as little as, on average, an hour a day. Now, that standard headlight bulb at an hour a day should be good for something between 16 and 33 months. Are you about to tell me that your headlights are older than that and haven't burned out? Maybe. But one more factor here is that headlights fade over time and will lose a significant amount of deliverable brightness long before they just blink out. Also, some cars and some drivers run headlights full time as running lights. It's another one of those crazy cases where simple math can't offer a simple answer. But there are some numbers that ought to help you understand headlights a little better. I told you that standard halogen headlights have a rated life expectancy of 450 to 1,000 hours. Xenon, or HID, headlights are rated 2,000 hours. And LED headlights, 15,000 hours. By the way, there's a little trick that's used a lot in talking about headlight runtime. Instead of seeing it specified in hours, you'll see it specified, you're ready for this, it's specified in KM. That's short for kilo minutes. In other words, 1,000 minutes, which is 16 and two-thirds hours. That's as far as I want to go down that road. Obviously, if you can bump up the life expectancy of a headlight from 450 or 1,000 or 2,000 hours to 15,000 hours, well, it seems like a good thing. But it's not the only reason for seeing more and more LED headlights on new cars and as replacements in older cars, because compared to halogen or HID headlights, an LED headlamp can deliver just as much light while using a lot less power. And the less power a car's alternator needs to produce, the less of a load it presents to the engine. That's because the alternator presents less magnetic drag for the engine to overcome. And less of a load on the engine means better fuel economy. Also, LED headlamps don't get anywhere near as hot as halogen or HID headlamps, so they can get by with lighter weight lenses and housings, and that weight savings means, again, better fuel economy. So it's kind of a win-win-win. Except maybe in win-win winter. LED headlamps may not create enough heat to melt off stubborn coatings of ice or snow. As I mentioned last month, and it's really important, and everybody should do this anyway, anytime you need to clear the ice and snow off your windshield, you need to also clear it off your headlights. And while you're at it, maybe your taillights and turn signals too. Hey, I don't also have to remind you about the side view mirrors, do I? Let's get back to the wattage. LED bulbs draw less current, we said that. So they create less magnetic resistance in the alternator so the engine doesn't have to work as hard to spin the alternator. Big deal, no big deal, you decide. But there's another phase to this that's also interesting. Have you ever, and I don't care if it was deliberate or an accident, have you ever left the headlights on with the engine off? Was it long enough, you know, headlights on, engine off, was that happening for a long enough time that it got to be a little harder to crank the engine when you wanted to start it again? Did you need to get a jump in order to get going? The car battery is another piece in the orchestra under your hood that can sometimes butt heads with headlights. When your alternator isn't running, your battery isn't charging. When your alternator isn't running but your headlights are, your battery is very definitely discharging. At some point, it reaches a point where there isn't enough juice left to crank the engine. But the point I want you to remember in all of this is that however soon that may happen with traditional headlights, it won't happen nearly as soon for LED headlights. I believe it will come out to be about 6 times longer before running your LED headlights will put you in that need-a-jump place. Next time, I'll take you past the usual 3 dimensions and into a 4th dimension without which you couldn't possibly, no human can, hear me. The 4th dimension is mandatory for human hearing. Vision can work in 3 dimensions or even 2. Hearing needs 4. And one of the ways to understand it involves something you may not have seen for a while, blowing smoke rings. Join me for an earful of information, not smoke.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open and free to the public. The Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation on Impeachment from a Legal Point of View, Thursday, December the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams New York Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting Friday, December the 6th. Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue, and it's at Scotch Plains, New Jersey. King's Byte Computer Club will have a presentation on Android cell phones and tablets. Tuesday, December the 10th, meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, December the 12th, 6:45 p.m., in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation, Transitioning from Windows 7 to Windows 10, and I'll be part of that presentation. Thursday, December the 12th, meeting time is 7 p.m., at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building. That's in Manhattan, New York, and check at the front desk for the room number and bring a photo with you for personal ID. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherr Hall. We hope to see you at some of these meetings, and if you have an announcement for me to make regarding your meetings, just send me a note at hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.